disturbing visions of flag covered coffins each day. United we stand while they're warring our future away. The spin doctors dance while our young men continue to die. All for the sake of the corporate American pie. It's a conspiracy of silence. It's breaking us down. The conspiracy of silence. The truth won't be found. The president seems to have dangerous thoughts in his head. His warm-minded handlers are pushing him over the edge. Protecting the interests of all their industrial friends. The sins of the father repeating all over again. It's a conspiracy of silence that's taking us down. The conspiracy of silence. The truth can't be found. Again, how September 11th will justify all of your unjustifiable wars. It's a conspiracy. This time we demanded they answer the questions they've asked. Make them return to us all of our freedoms they've robbed. The seeds of Big Brother have started to take root and spread. If we don't rise up, we'll find out democracy's dead. It's a conspiracy of silence.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Mike Pesca talk about dirty politics and big money. And in this part, he's talking about the accusations that Nancy Pelosi was influencing legislation concerning Visa and swipe fees.
So here is, I'm not going to tout it as Nancy Pelosi's explanation, but this was her literal response to when Steve Croft, in the same way that he asked John Boehner, didn't get an appointment with Nancy Pelosi. It's not like she doesn't do tons of interviews. She didn't want to talk about this. Steve Croft went to her press conference, asked her the question. Here was her reaction.
I guess what I'm asking is, do you think it's all right for a speaker to accept a very preferential and favorable stock deal?
Well, we didn't.
And you participated in the IPO.
Well, I have many.
And at the time you were Speaker of the House. You don't think it was a conflict of interest or had the appearance of a conflict
not,
of interest?
No, it doesn't. It only has the appearance if you decide that you're going to have elaborate on a false premise.
Thomas Ferguson, what do you make of Nancy Pelosi seemingly not to even understand what this charge was?
I won't try to say I know what's going on in the speaker's head. I have to tell you that if you have banks and investment houses calling up members of Congress or their spouses and offering them special IPO offers that the rest of us aren't off to, anybody should be able to see that that's a serious problem. Anybody over the mental age of 9 should understand that that's really a problem. I mean, the thing is on its face, but I don't know the case on the transaction. I mean, Peter did the work on it, not me. And I know only what I saw in the CBS transcript. This type of stuff needs to be banned. It's not, I mean, as I said earlier, this IPO, and as Peter said, the IPOs have a long history with members of Congress. They got to get out of that business. They got to ban it, absolutely. And I would add this, and I assume Peter would agree with me, you have to cover the members of the staff, too. I mean, the congressional
yes.
staffs can't be allowed to trade in this stuff. I think there's actually a problem with that, too. That's harder to get at. We have a very comprehensive problem, but it is, as I say, only part of the problem in money and politics.
And I wanted to get to, and we have Jack Abramoff standing by. We'll get to him in a moment. But first, let me introduce this. We heard Nancy Pelosi talking about it's only an appearance of the conflict of interest if you think it appears that way. Maybe we need a better phrase for the appearance of conflict of interest, because even if there is no conflict of interest, it seems like all these senators and representatives are defending themselves by saying, but that's not true. There was really no quid pro quo. They seem not to get that it undermines faith in democracy, even if the stink is on them, even if they're not the ones who are truly emitting the smell. I mean, the analogy I think of is a cop on the beat can't take an apple from the grocer. And every cop will tell you, I'm not going to give that grocer special privileges because he gave me the apple. I'm not going to not investigate a crime at the grocer down the street. But the point is, we want people to have faith in our cops, so we don't let them take the apple. My question to you, Thomas Ferguson, is the big difference here that cops don't get to write the laws that affect cops, but lawmakers do?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think anybody can see what's going on here. I mean, this is just plain a corrupt system. And you can always take on individual cases the defense, my motives were really pure. We should get out of that game. The stuff needs to be banned. Let me move the discussion just a touch to a related issue. There is some good work on congressional staffs, and there's a very nice paper where three folks showed that when congressional staff leave the staff and they go out to lobby, if they're working for a U.S. senator, basically when that senator finally retires, their income abruptly drops 20%. I mean, that is to say, it's very clear evidence that you are in fact selling influence here.
That their usefulness to the lobbyist is that their ex-boss is in office. Let's bring in Jack Abramoff. Jack Abramoff is a super lobbyist. He is now the author of Capital Punishment, The Hard Truth About Washington Corruption from America's Most Notorious Lobbyist. Hello, Mr. Abramoff.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
And what Thomas Ferguson was just talking about, you say that was, if not the biggest, one of the biggest weapons in your arsenal to lure a staff member with the possibility of employment. Tell me how you use that one.
Yes, no, absolutely. It's one of the biggest problems out there, which is basically as soon as I developed a relationship with an office, and I'm not alone, by the way. One shouldn't think that just because I'm not in there, it's not happening.
You're not the revolving door. You just capitalized on it.
Exactly. This revolving door basically allows people to go from public service to cash in and become wealthy and become lobbyists. And what I would do and what other lobbyists do is offer a job to a staffer on the Hill. The second the job's offered, especially if they're going to take it, even if a couple of years down the line, that from that minute on, they're owned by that lobbying firm. Their loyalty switch, and that is utter corruption.
What is your take on the revelations of Peter Schweitzer's book? I don't know how, if you've read it. You have actually coinciding book tours, so maybe you've been pretty busy. But is it known in Washington that this goes on, that insider trading is winked at?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's first of all, Peter's book is brilliant. I haven't read it. I've had parts of it read to me, and I've certainly heard about it in the press. And it's a magnificent and important addition to this discussion. This activity is emblematic of the problem in Washington, and this particularly where the Congress draws rules that apply to all of us and don't apply to them. And the other point I would make is that on the insider trading side, you know, it's almost worse than insider trading as we know it. Insider trading as we know it is companies having inside information and using it to advantage. People on the Hill have information that the company don't even have yet, and they're using it to profit. And it's a real disgrace.
Let me read some blurbs from the back of your book. Paul Begala, Jack Abramoff, he's scum. Richard Benveniste, this stuff could gag a magnet. Margaret Carlson, the most evil lobbyist ever to be operating in Washington. These are the people on the back of your book that you chose to put there.
Right.
You call yourself, you say, I was a lobbyist thug. I'm not going to say the come to Jesus moment, because I know that is not your faith. But was it getting caught? Was it going to jail? Or was it a nagging sense while you're doing it all along that this should not be the way, I should not be able to be as successful as I am? Where did you change your tune?
Well, I wish it were the latter. I wish it was the last one, to be honest with you, because then I probably would have changed my tune. But it was getting hit on the head by a 2x4 and having the stuffing kicked out of me, and finally realizing after everything was gone, well, why is it all gone, and taking a look back. And it was before I went to prison. When I went to prison, that was sort of the bottom thud of a long fall. And in prison, I frankly had finally an opportunity to sit back and say, well, something's got to be done about this. And unfortunately, for better or for worse, I have some knowledge here most people don't have. And so I'm going to try to design some reforms that I, as a lobbyist, would have done everything I could do to fight. And that's what I did in my book, among other things.
And the reforms that were there that were passed, I mean, there was a mini spasm of reform a few years ago. Were you ever actually seriously affected in how you did your job by any reforms that were passed while you were a lobbyist? Did anything really ever put a crimp in your style?
Not only is the answer to that no, but it's actually worse than that. Lobbyists look for these reform bills, and they're gleeful because they know that people who are putting them forward are not going to really get too serious because they want to, A, be lobbyists, and B, they want to benefit from the perquisites why they're in there. So there's nothing that they're going to put forward that's really going to affect the lobbyists. And it's even worse than that because lobbyists look for reform bills, and I write about this in my book, as moving trains. In other words, bills that are going to probably pass the House and the Senate and get signed by the president. And so lobbyists, clever lobbyists, look to try to put onto those moving trains all sorts of garbage that has nothing to do with reform. I myself try to do it to the Help America Vote Act, where I try to put a provision to get a casino legalized in Texas. So
yeah, I can see how that would help America vote. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Not only are these efforts feckless in the Congress, they're far worse than it. And the worst thing probably does it enables them to run around patting themselves on the back and telling everybody, oh, go back to sleep, the problem's solved. The problem is not solved.
As you were doing all the things you did, and as you were taking members of Congress to Redskins games or wining and dining them legally in ways that were allowed, and maybe we'll get to that in a second, but as you were doing it, was it easier for you to justify your actions? Well, first of all, I'm sure you thrilled to being a political warrior, and it was exciting, and you were mostly passing laws that, or largely passing laws that coincided with your ideology, but was it easier to say, I don't care if I'm screwing with Congress, or I don't care if my actions are striking at the point of Congress, because your own ideology is one that says government isn't the solution, government is the problem. I mean, one of your best friends is Grover Norquist, who talked about becoming physically ill the first time he saw the buildings in Washington. So is this a conservative ideology of government being the problem? Did it in any way enable or embolden you?
I don't think the conservative ideology did. I think that what probably kept me going was the sense that I was having great victories for clients that, you know, that I agreed with their causes. The causes were coincident in many cases with my philosophies, including conservative philosophies, number one. Number two, the fact that I was making for them lots of money. They paid me about $80 million in fees, and I accumulated for them probably about $6 billion in value. So I felt really good about that. I was making a lot of money. I was giving away 80% of my money to charity and community causes. So I felt good about that. I felt good, 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 and I didn't get a chance to stop and say, this is all great, but you're destroying the country. You're destroying the fabric of democracy. I didn't have that thought never entered my head, unfortunately.
I just need to follow up on that 80% to charity. It has been noted that some of your charities seem to have been not on the up and up. I'm thinking of one that was supposedly for sports in Washington, D.C., where the majority of the money never went to the stated cause.
Well, you should know that's been discussed in the media. I'm glad you brought that up. That charity started as an educational charity to fund schools. 90% of the money went to fund schools there. What I did was, in mid-course, I was going to change it to be a sports foundation to promote good sportsmanship. And we started spending money on that. And unfortunately, by the time we started to get a little head of steam up, I was done.
This is On Point. I'm Mike Pesca for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about power, corruption, and big money in Washington. You can join the conversation. Would you vote against your own representative or senator if you found out they were using their position to get rich on the stock market? There is a short story in Peter Schweitzer's book where a senator or congressman was voted out because they weren't getting rich. He must be stupid, his constituents thought. We're joined this hour by the aforementioned Peter Schweitzer, research fellow at the Hoover Institution and author of the new book, Throw Them Out. Also by Thomas Ferguson, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Boston, senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and Capital Punishment is the name of the book. Jack Abramoff is the author, Washington's most notorious lobbyist, he acknowledges right there in the subtitle. Peter Schweitzer, a question for you. John Kerry fought back against some of the accusations you put against him, which is that he profited from insider knowledge, similar accusation that you put forth and document with these other ones. And here's what he said. To link me to such behavior is beyond inaccurate. I am writing today to seek a public acknowledgement that Mr. Schweitzer, who did not present these accusations to me or my office for a response, erred in making these assumptions and accusations in the case. And the assumptions were that he had personal knowledge of the investments that he was making. He denied wrongdoing and says that independent trustees manage financial holdings for both him and his wife, Teresa. Again, and I didn't put the question to you, I come to the question of appearance of conflict of interest. Even if that all is true, you know, what doesn't John Kerry and all these other elected officials we've been talking about, what don't they get in terms of how bad this looks, even if he wasn't making the investments?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. Let me give you an analogy. An analogy I use in the book is that we don't like it if we would never tolerate it if professional athletes were betting on their own games,
right,
the games they were participating in.
Even if they were betting on themselves, even if, yes.
Exactly. And you know, as I point out is that, you know, if Michael Jordan said, well, I wasn't betting on these games, it was my manager that was doing it, we still wouldn't tolerate it. And I think the point that I make in the book with John Kerry is that he was involved in 2003 with the Medicare prescription drug bill, in 2009 with the health care reform debate. And if you look at the stock portfolios that he and his wife have, you see this amazing pattern of stock activity. In 2003, people didn't know what that bill was going to finally look like when it passed. But in his investment portfolio, there were 111 stock transactions involving Big Pharma. 103 of them were buys. He was very bullish on Big Pharma, even though nobody knew that that bill was going to pass and be very good for Big Pharma. So I guess the point that I would make is, again, if this were John Kerry, CEO, and there was this pattern of behavior related to his corporate activities, and he said, well, yeah, I don't do this. This is my broker that does this. I don't think people would accept that. John Kerry does not have a blind trust. He has access to those managers. And, you know, we are expected to take the word of politicians that there is no information exchange going on here.
Go ahead, Thomas Ferguson.
I think the really analytically decisive issue here is the performance of the portfolio. And Senator Kerry, Speaker Pelosi, and former Speaker Pelosi and Speaker Boehner all have very simple defenses. If they can publish the results of their portfolio, we can see straight away how well they do over market. When you see impossibly high rates of return, no investment advisor can do what U.S. senators have been shown to do in the Zabrowski and Boyd paper. I mean, not 12 or 13% a year better than market. I mean, this, they're playing a game here where they don't get, they hide the statistics. It's real tough to get those and work them out. And it's time to open those up.
Right.
Let them publish the whole thing if they want to defend themselves.
And even if John Kerry and even if John Boehner and even if those cases, they didn't know what their investors were doing, the point is the institution itself. And as you say, you can't get those returns. Also pointed out in the book, Peter Schweitzer doesn't just document dozens of individuals. He points to a lot of the research. And one of the interesting things was, for instance, Denny Hastert didn't make a lot of money when he was a relatively unpowerful congressman when he rose to the position of Speaker of the House. Well, guess what? That's one of the times that he started enriching himself. Jack Abramoff, it seems to me that so much of this goes to character, and you know how to get to a congressman. You know how to get to a senator. I think there's a line in Ecclesiastes that you quote about, corruption isn't for the stupid guy, it's for the wise guy. Did you think anyone could be gotten in Washington?
Well, ultimately, at some level, they're all participating in a corrupt system. And whether or not they're able to resist it or not, you know, you put human beings into an environment, and by the way, aggressive human beings, don't forget who runs for office.
Mm-hmm.
They're not type B personalities. These are people who are aggressive. And you put them into a system that is rife with possibilities and corrupt scenarios, you're going to have this outcome. This shouldn't be surprising to people.
What?
I mean, on the insider trading thing, the fact that they have laws that apply to everybody else and don't apply to them is an outrage. But what did we expect would happen?
Were there any congressmen where someone came to you and said, I need the vote of Jeff Flake or Senator Tom Coburn, to just name two Republicans with great reputations? Maybe they thought you could get to Republicans, and you would say, he's going to be the tough one. Either those two or anyone else were just really ethical in your mind?
There are definitely people up there who are ethical. And by the way, that doesn't mean that they can't be lobbied. And I should say, by the way, lobbying itself is not a bad thing. I think lobbying is a tool. We have
It's lobbying plus money. Lobbying is just...
Right, exactly. Where the money comes into play is where the problem exists.
Right.
And where they can profit from their position and become wealthy, as you've been describing, is where the problem comes into play. And yeah, there are members up there that don't do it. And with my practice, it wasn't that everything we did was corrupt and evil and bad and things like that. We did go over the line in a number of areas. What I'm trying to say is that the entire system has to be totally revamped and totally relooked at. There are some systemic things in there that have got to be fixed, and if they're not, we can rearrange the chairs on the deck of the Titanic all we want, but this ship is going down.
I have not read the whole book, though I've read much of it. There's a great deal of humor in there, I can say, and I don't think that no matter how good sales are, it's going to make a huge dent in the $44 million in restitution that you owe. But I did want to ask you, this perhaps pales since we're talking about the very nature of government in America, but you had so many emails, and some of them had very insulting language towards your Native American clients. Do you repudiate that language in the book?
Well, let me just put this a little in context. I sent 850,000 emails. Okay, over the course of 10 years. I had diarrhea of the email, and I became the poster child for don't put in email those things that you don't want to read in the front page of the Washington Post. Unfortunately, I read lots of my emails on the front page of the Washington Post. I sent a lot of stupid emails, and by the way, not just about my Native American clients, about all my clients and everybody I was in business with and people. I was a passionate guy. I sent emails to my wife about behavior of our kids that were similar to what I would say about my clients when they didn't do what I wanted them to do. I was in such an ego power position at that point that if people didn't do what I wanted, I got all emotional and I was stupid. I loved my clients. That I sent a bunch of, or a few, stupid emails. I'm sorry about it. I'm mortified. I will never, ever be able to live it down. And I apologize for it. But they were some stupid emails among 850,000 others. They weren't emblematic of how I felt about my clients. What I delivered for my clients, for right or for wrong, by the way, that when I was in the lobbying area, that's how I felt about my clients. I worked my guts out for them. I sacrificed for them. And we delivered for them. Now, having said that, I wish I hadn't been in the business altogether. But having said that, at least I can answer at least part of that question.
Okay, let's take a call. Bob is calling from Winooski, Vermont. Hello, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I want to say, first of all, I'm not cynical about this. I just think I'm realistic. If you see a rabid dog and it bites you, you know, you don't say, oh, that's a nasty dog. It's a rabid dog. Mm-hmm. And I think it's systemic here, as he just said. The question I have a comment first. I think it was the Wizard of Id who said, he who has the gold makes the rules. And that's the case here. And if it were to change, I have a question. I'm leading up to a question.
Okay.
If it were to change, if a law was passed that these bastards should not be allowed to do this, they already will have written in a law to countermand that. I absolutely believe in that. You see it all the time. My question is this, I hope I'm not being perceived as cynical here or just doubtful, but those people who are considered left, I never considered Nancy Pelosi or any of those people left people. Are they also benefiting from this? Are they also looting the treasury?
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I'm gonna sing. Oh, I'm gonna sing. Lift up your voice and then
sing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Place for where our people
rise. we shall sing a song. Aretha Franklin and Al Green Cash said they could sing, yes.
Can you hear them sing?
Amelia Jackson and Albertina Walker and Shirley Caesar could
said
they could sing, yes.
Can you hear them sing?
Bob Marley and Big Youth and Jimmy Cliff
can do it.
Oh, they could sing, yes.
Can you hear them sing?
Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and Shirley Horn can
do it.
Oh, they could sing, yes.
Can you hear them sing?
Yeah.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.